Which brings us back to Voyager and that golden disc, about which Tim Radford has written one of the loveliest books ever, On the Constellations of Physics.
At the end of November 2017, scientists and engineers based at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, fired up a motor that had not been used for 37 years. They sent a command to a spacecraft to ignite a thruster to shift its position and alter the angle of the antenna. Since the spacecraft was 13 billion miles from planet Earth, the command, travelling at the speed of light, took more than 19 hours to reach it. Then the engineers had to wait another 19 hours and 35 minutes to find out whether their manoeuvre had worked. It had. Thrusters puffed bursts of gas from their nozzles for a hundredth of a second to turn the spacecraft fractionally so that its antenna pointed in the desired direction. The command was a simple one, and its success had no immediate significance. It was a test and no more, but the achievement made the broadcast bulletins and news headlines. That is because the spacecraft was Voyager 1, the first man-made object to leave the solar system. It is a twin sister ship to Voyager 2, the only observer to visit the outer planets Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, before it too began to head for the space between the Sun and the other stars. And in the course of this journey, Voyager had gradually become one of the icons of modern science. It is both an instrument and exemplar, not just of human curiosity, but of the joy, a delight that is intellectual, aesthetic, and emotional, of exploring what is beyond the horizon and beneath the surface of things.
That little craft is still travelling, even though it's small and over 40 years old. It's going on and on outside our solar system. Is it likely to bump into anything, do you think?
It's possible that something might try and intercept it in some unimaginable future. But the timescale of a journey, even at 16 kilometres a second, the timescale of a journey to another star is astronomical, and it's not even pointing at the nearest star. It's just going somewhere in the galaxy. And since the galaxy is moving at some colossal speed, rotating around itself, and all the other stars are dancing up and down in this sort of eternal ballet of the heavens, it may never hit anything, or it may smash into an asteroid, but I don't think so. I think it's not going to hit anything.
It may outlast civilization.
Oh, it will outlast civilization. That's guaranteed. Civilization will not last. No matter how carefully we preserve it, it will not last beyond 5 billion years, because that's when the sun runs out and swells up into an orange or red giant and certainly consumes Earth and all its artifacts, and everything that we've ever built will be just little cinders floating around in space waiting to be recycled in some other possible civilization.
Now, they had a window of opportunity when all of the planets were kind of lined up, so that otherwise they would have had to wait another 100 years or so. And so the two Voyagers went, and one of them carried recordings, famous recordings of our music and some of our pictures and so on.
Yes.
And it was such an exciting thing. It's the first mention you have of the great works of physics that inspire you and console you so much. How come?
Why do they console me so much? Voyager was certainly the first time I suddenly realised what a gap there was between what my colleagues in journalism knew about the universe and what Voyager was telling us. I have a strange little story about that. When Voyager flew past Saturn, that was the point at which the world took notice. So they knew about Jupiter. People had been to Jupiter before, after a fashion. But it flew past Saturn, and suddenly the American Physical Society, you and I will both remember this, staged a sort of a piece of theatre in which they all cried out loudly, "Gosh, we'll have to rewrite the laws of physics," and "Wow, this is amazing." And we all knew that actually what Voyager did was to confirm what Victorian astronomers thought, confirmed it. That's really something, that the rings of Saturn were just little blocks of ice, a disk of loose bits of ice whizzing around and looking like a solid platform to earlier astronomers.
Yes, indeed. And it's interesting, as you point out in this beautiful book, how little 40, 50 years ago we knew about those planets. But tell me, What was the inspiration of the Consolations of Philosophy, the other book, going back?
Well, my title is a tribute to a work by Boethius, who is a Roman senator in the Italian kingdom of Theodoric the Goth. This is after the fall of Rome and after Rome became overtaken by what some people would call the Philistines, although that's ridiculous. They were just good old-fashioned Vandals. We know nothing about them either, by the way, but we knew even less about the planets. That was the paradox. We could revisit the quite distant past. We could revisit St. Augustine and Boethius and even Plato, but we knew nothing about Pluto or Neptune or Uranus. We knew only that they were there and that they revolved and they actually had a timetable that could be predicted. I have kept books from the 50s, Arthur C. Clarke telling us what space was going to be like, of course, before anyone went there. And he's quite calm about the idea of Venus being inhabited because he doesn't know that it's so hot. There was no way of knowing until radio astronomy, I suppose, and optical astronomy itself became ever more remarkable. And indeed, what we knew about Venus had to be confirmed by early Soviet missions. So everything has been a voyage of discovery, and strangely, everything we've learned about the other planets has told us even more how remarkable the Earth itself is and what a glorious accident we are, why we ought to really appreciate what we've got. And this is a truism now, but it was something that did emerge during the space race.
The interesting thing about Tim Radford is that you were, in fact, a literary editor and you hadn't got a degree in physics or other sciences. And all of this came from the experience of being involved in science itself and writing about it. How did you manage?
Well, the same way that you manage. You just ask questions. If you can't ask an intelligent question, ask a stupid one. You still get a good answer. In fact, dumb questions actually get simpler answers than too clever questions. I've always maintained that journalism was an ongoing university course that will last you a lifetime. But our papers are marked by not only the people who gave us the information, but by 500,000 other readers as well. So there is an incentive to try and get on top of the subject. And you can't start asking questions about Voyager or about the Large Hadron Collider or about LIGO, the gravity wave astronomy instrument that we've tested in 2016.
All of this in your own career and lifetime.
Yes, yes, that's the great fortune. I could walk around and meet these people and say hi. And I even ended up at CERN several times in Geneva, just marvelling at the sheer amazingness of it all, and the fact that it seemed to require 10,000 physicists and engineers just to make the thing work.
And when you look at what they've achieved and the excitement around the world, who would have thought that it was front page headlines when gravitational waves were spotted by LIGO about 3 years ago and the follow-up, or Higgs for that matter?
Yeah.
People did not know that this was particularly accessible in terms of their own ideas, but they knew it was important and there was a huge thrill everywhere.
There was a huge thrill everywhere, and that was actually something that has happened in your lifetime and mine, and we may be even in our tiny way a part of actually making it like this. When I started reporting on science, the idea that a science discovery, no matter how momentous, would actually make the front page was near zero. Just wasn't going to happen. News desks thought that science was something you did in the silly season when you were desperate for stories and there was nothing else around. You could always have a wacky science story. Somehow that gradually changed. What makes the discoveries of, say, the Higgs boson in particular more startling is that even now you and I couldn't tell each other what was actually discovered. In fact, it wasn't discovered. We know that what they saw was the trace of a signal that could only have had a precursor that, if you saw it often enough, would turn out to have been the Higgs at some distant point in the very early past, almost a squillionth of a second before the observation you'd made. That you couldn't put the Higgs in a bottle. You couldn't exhibit it in a museum. You couldn't put it in the bank and sell it to someone afterwards. It was, in fact, a kind of strange non-discovery. That itself was quite extraordinary, that we could make that exciting.
My final question comes back to the other excitement, and that was Apollo. 50 years ago, the landing, as we know, and I was as kind of laid back and not bothered about it. when it turned out to be my first job in broadcasting. And I was involved with Apollo 16 and 17. And I remember your words very simply, without any kind of artifice. God, it was exciting.
It was exciting. It was the most wonderful 10 years of my life. I joined the New Zealand Herald in 1957, in April 1957, and in October 1957, there was Sputnik 1, and it flew over New Zealand. And as a reporter, I was required to man the phone and take reports from people who'd seen it. And it turned out to be a clear night, and everybody in New Zealand saw it and tried to ring the New Zealand Herald, so it was quite difficult to get anything written. But it was my first science story, Sputnik 1. After that, you can't not be absolutely riveted by what happened. The launch of Gagarin was so exciting that I felt I'd been in space. And the extraordinary narrative that followed of extravehicular activity, we now call it, or spacewalks, meetings in space, encounters between two spacecraft, and then, of course, the whole Apollo story, in which I remember Michael Collins pointing out that Apollo had more than 5 million working parts, and if they all worked to 99.99% accuracy, there were still 5,000 things that could go wrong, any one of which could have sunk the mission.
Tim Radford's book is The Consolations of Physics, immensely enjoyable, and he lives in London and also writes for the journal Nature. Next week, The Science Show brings you the Prime Minister's Prizes for Science and the connection between power stations in the Latrobe Valley and Barramundi. Production for The Science Show by David Fisher and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Robin Williams.